Good morning, and welcome to this Wednesday, November 4th, 2015 edition of Writers on Writing. We're on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine, streaming on the web at kuci.org, and also available via podcast. More about that during the second half of the show. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. Each week, Barbara, Marie, or I talk to authors, poets, or literary agents to give you insight and up-to-date information on the art and business of writing and publishing. I'll be talking to two guests this hour. During the second half of the show, I'll be on with debut novelist Garth Risk-Hallberg, author of City on Fire. But first up, novelist Lauren Groff. Lauren is the author of the novel The Monsters of Templeton, shortlisted for the Orange Prize for New Writers, Delicate Edible Birds, a collection of stories, and Arcadia, a New York Times notable book, winner of the Medici Book Club Prize, and finalist for the LA Times Book Award. Her work has appeared in journals including The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, Harper's, Tin House, One Story, McSweeney's, and Plowshares. Her new novel, a National Book Award finalist, is Fates and Furies, published by Riverhead Books. And I am so pleased to welcome her back to the show. Hi there, Lauren.
Hi, Nicole. It's so lovely to be back on the show.
Well, let's go ahead and dive in. So can we start by having you tell us about the book, Fates and Furies?
Sure. So this book came from my sort of essential ambivalence about marriage, even though I am myself married. And, I have some resistance to the idea of it as an institution. At the same time, it's the best thing that I've ever done in my life. And so I wanted to think about issues of not only marriage, but privilege and power and time and sex and things like that and creativity. This book is very much a book about creativity in the points of view of a husband and wife. The husband's name is Lotto Satterwhite and his wife is Mathilde. And the first part of the book is sort of in Lotto's world and his perspective. And the second part switches over to Mathilde. And so it's a very different book from my last one. It's much more operatic in a lot of ways.
And you mentioned there the structure of the book. So it starts from Lotto's point of view and then ends the second half with Mathilde's. And I'd love to hear more about that decision because, I mean, on the surface, it seems kind of, I don't know, maybe even obvious, but I bet it didn't start that way. And so could you talk about finding that structure for the story?
Sure. Well, I had believed it for a long, long time when I was writing this book, but I was actually writing two books. And my model for that was Mr. Bridge and Mrs. Bridge by the great writer Evan S. Connell. Those are just extraordinary books. And so I thought, you know, of course you would have to tell a marriage in two points of view. For a long time, you know, I wrote them simultaneously, the two parts, so that I was able to see scenes from opposite points of view and sort of develop the characters together almost the same way that, you know, I've been with my husband since I was basically a child. And we have grown up together and become adults together in a real way. And I sort of wanted my characters to do that too as I was developing them. So eventually I gave these, what I thought was two books, my agent, and he looked at me and he said, "This is absolutely insane, because what you have to do actually is replicate the idea of a marriage. You know, they're two autonomous individuals within this one structure." And I, as soon as he said that, I said, "Oh, you're right. So it is actually just one book." And the other thing too is it's kind of important to read the book the way that it's set up. So Lotto is first, and then Mathilde second. And I hadn't really thought that through as well as I probably should have, with the idea of the two books instead of one. But he was right, and it ended up being one book, sort of replicating the idea of a marriage.
And also, I have to admit, this is the first book of yours that I've read, so I don't know for sure whether you've written as extensively from a male point of view before. But regardless, could you talk about any challenges you had getting into Lotto's male head?
Yeah, so my last book, Arcadia, was in the perspective of Bit Stone, who is a boy. And I sort of saw him through from birth all the way through when he was about 50 years old. So it's not foreign to me to write in the perspective of a man. I've written a number of short stories in male perspectives as well, and I think it's really fun. I mean, my initial impulse is to make men very, very different from women, when in reality, you know, we're not all the same, but as long as you dig as deeply down as you possibly can, you know, and you worry about sort of motivations and ideas, character is character, and people come out of, you know, their backgrounds and the things that they choose to do. So it's not incredibly difficult to write from the point of view of a man, but it does take perhaps a little bit more thought and more consideration.
Mm. I'm talking to Lauren Groff. Her new novel is Fates and Furies. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And Lauren, would you read to us from the book?
Sure. This is from Lotto's part, and I'm not going to read very much of it, but he's about halfway through his life, and he just came home from time away from his wife, so... After the incomprehension and the raw fish came the long flight, then the short. At last, home. He sat watching through the window as the staircase approached the plain over the sun-shot asphalt. Spring rain had blown through as they taxied in and just as swiftly was gone. He wanted his face in Mathilde's neck, the soothe of her hair. 2 weeks as playwright in residence in Osaka and as long as he'd ever been away from his wife. Too much. His happiness stretched out its wings and gave a few flaps. He hadn't accounted for the other passengers' impatience. It wasn't until he was already midair that he felt the hand hard in the middle of his back. How outrageous, he thought. Pushed. Now the pavement was billowing up toward him like a split tablecloth, one distant windsock tonguing eastward, the crenellated roof of the airport building, a shine of the sandpapery steps in the sunlight. The plane's nose somehow peeling into his vision and the pilot stretching his arms in the window. And Lancelot had twisted entirely around by the time his right shoulder hit the edge of the stair and he was looking at his ostensible pusher looming up at the dark cave mouth at the top. A man with tomato-colored hair and face, lines embossed in his forehead, wearing madras shorts of all ugly things. Lancelot's head hit the tread at the moment his rear and legs did it somewhat lower, and things got a bit slimy now. And behind the man was the flight attendant who snuck Lancelot too many bottles of bourbon after he'd spent a few minutes exercising his old actor's charm on her. And she was in the process of putting her hand slowly up to her mouth as his body made a satisfying funk-a-funk-a-funk rhythm and sliding downward and kicked out toward the rail with the instinct to stop his fall, but felt a curious, sharp clicking in the shin region and all in that general direction went numb. With delicious slowness, he came to rest in a shallow puddle, his shoulder and ear seeping up the sun-warmed water, his legs still extended up the stairs, though his foot, it appeared, canted outward in a manner unbefitting its owner's dignity. Down now, the tomato-headed man was coming, a moving stop sign. His footsteps wrought some locus of pain in Lancelot. When the man was close, Lancelot held up the hand that wasn't numb, but the man stepped over him. He got a flash of the tube of the man's shorts, hairy white thigh, dark tangle. Then the man was running over the shining asphalt swallowed up by the slab of a terminal door. The flight attendant's face came into view, soft cheeks and hoarse nostrils blowing, and Lotto closed his eyes as she touched his neck and someone somewhere began to shout. So that was Lotto just falling out of a plane. what happens after he does that sort of changes his life.
Thank you. That was Lauren Groff reading from her new novel, Fates and Furies. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI in Irvine. And as you mentioned in that section, so he's coming home from this playwriter in residence experience, and there you include in the novel portions of these plays and the plot lines. And I'm curious about that challenge, that task that you set yourself up for. How did that work when you were writing? Was it especially hard or was that a fun part?
No, it was really, really, really fun. You know, I had never written a play before, and I didn't really know how to do it. But what I knew that I wanted to do was to show snippets of Lotto's own work and to sort of reflect back on his life, perhaps in ways he didn't even realize he himself, the creator of these things, was doing as these examples sort of came into the world. So my motive for each of the plays plays that I sort of excerpted were sort of numerous, right? I mean, I had to not only show his development as a writer, I had to show progression through time and how he himself progressed through time, and I had to show him sort of reflecting backward on his own life and his own experiences and changing them through art. And so it was just incredibly fun to do because my instincts as a writer are to write, I mean, I love description, right? And plays are mostly dialogue. And setting that challenge was just really, really exciting to me.
And so there were the plots of these plays that you allude to in, you know, Lotto's thread, and also the plot generally of the novel is subtle but very complex at the same time. And when it circles back, it opens up and there are these intersections and connections that are so satisfying and unexpected as a reader. So I would love it if you would talk about plotting as a skill.
Oh my God, I wish. So here's the thing, and I know you know this, but every time you sit down to write something, you have no idea what you're doing, right? I mean, you're sort of making it up as you go along. And it's so frustrating for so many years because you just sort of guess at where you're going and what you're doing. But I've developed a, sort of a method to play with that sense of loss or being lost, actually. And the method is really just to write a few very quick drafts, throwing them out. After I finished the draft, and then I would start the next one with a better sense of who the characters are or a better sense of, you know, the direction in which the work is going to go. And I do this, you know, draft after draft in longhand until one day I realize that I actually know the story and I actually know the characters pretty well. And in fact, I know far more of the story than will ever appear in the book itself. And it sounds very, very wasteful, but it's a way for me to not spend all of my time fixing works that have foundational issues. You know, if you just throw out the whole draft, then you can start over again fixing those foundational issues that have sort of shown themselves to you through the course of writing. So that's how I plot. I mean, it's not really plotting. It's just sort of understanding the story time and time again until I'm able to see my way through it by the very end.
I love that distinction. That's really interesting. And when you say it sounds wasteful, I don't think it sounds wasteful. It sounds incredibly disciplined because I think writers get too attached or too, I don't know, invested in the time they've put into something, or some do. But
yeah.
So, and I also heard that you've written 3 failed novels before you went to graduate school, or that's what you called them. And so I that kind of ties into what you were just saying about being able to let go of these drafts. And I would love to hear a little bit more about letting go of those manuscripts. Was that hard?
No, not at all. So the thing about those is I knew that they were just monstrously flawed and ugly. You know, yeah, I mean, we all need to have an apprenticeship somewhere and somehow, and that was the beginning of my apprenticeship, which I hope will never end. But the thing about throwing those out is that I realized one day that they're not gone forever, even though, you know, I don't physically have the papers. They sort of sit, all my failures sit in my head waiting for a time to find a way to be successful. So one of the novels, for instance, it was totally insane, but it was basically Abelard and Eloise set in a Scientology tower in New York City, which sounds stupid because it was. It was like a really, really tremendously bad book. But what I loved about it was sort of the foundational idea of Abelard and Eloise. And then a few years later, when I was in grad school, I read Ellen Bryant Boyd's amazing book of poetry, Curie, which is about the 1918 flu epidemic. And at the same time, I was doing some research into this Olympic swimmer named Iselda Blibtree, who had polio when she was a child and was able to come back and get a gold medal. And she's just this astonishing human being. And so suddenly, you know, my field novel, this Abelard Nellies thing, sort of collided with the idea of this incredible swimmer and then the 1918 flu epidemic. And suddenly I had a short story that ended up being, you know, the first story that was kind of published for me in the Atlantic, which was wonderful. So, you know, these things come back, and it's not that, you know, they're failures forever. They're just failures for now until I find the right way to talk or to think them through.
Mm. And switching gears just a little bit, I'm very curious to ask you. So you wrote a book about marriage, and you're married, and you've had to field a lot of questions as a female author in the vein of, you know, is this based on your marriage, and are you Mathilde? And other questions, even from, you know, well-intentioned interviewers. And I'm wondering whether you think people would be asking you those questions if you were male, and, you know, how that feels.
Yeah, so this is something I've dealt with a lot in my career so far. And the thing is, I mean, a lot of times I see where someone is coming from, and I see, you know, a lot of times people really deeply want to know and they want to connect. And so I see the sort of the impulse behind it, and I try to answer it civilly. I do think there's something about being a female writer that allows people to sort of identify who you are as a person with your characters in a way. And possibly it's the same with men, but, you know, I don't have that experience. I would say maybe not. I do get a lot of domestic questions about my own life. For instance, with my first book, there was a character who had a hysterical pregnancy, which I thought was funny. You know, like, I thought that it was hilarious, and so I put it in the book. And I went on the road with a book tour when that book came out, and I was pregnant. I was a good 6-month pregnant, so it was pretty obvious. And one lady in an audience stood up, and she said, "Are you really pregnant? Or is this a hysterical pregnancy?" And I just thought, how does, you know, how does that even compute? I mean, how do you think to ask that sort of question? And I get a lot of questions about, you know, how are you a mother also at the same time as being a writer? And these are great questions because people genuinely want to know, because balance is really difficult for everyone. But I don't see men getting these questions a lot. So, so you know, I'm not complaining, but I'm noticing.
Mm. Yeah, I'm noticing too. And I think it's nice of you to be charitable, and I think that's probably the best approach, because I think, you know, as an interviewer, these things don't always occur to you, but once you become aware, it's hard to unsee, but we'll see. We're drawing down on our time, but I'd love to ask you about more writing tips. So for our writer listeners out there, Lauren, do you have any advice?
Yeah, I have so much advice. And I'm actually a hermit, so I never get to talk about these things other than with my amazing Warren Wilson graduate students. But here's the biggest thing that I think for the life of a writer is just showing up every day. You really, you know, even if you can't write, and there are times when most of us are sitting a little bit sallow, you still sit at your desk, you know, and you still read a book, or you think, or you daydream, or you just show up physically. And that's it's not just showing up physically, you know, for the work, but it's also showing up physically for yourself as well, which means that, you know, exercise, you know, keep yourself healthy, do yoga, go running, you know, whatever you need to do to have a strong body, because a strong body makes for the ability to sit there for long stretches of time and wait for the stories to come for you. So, I mean, that's my biggest, most major tip. And being charitable to oneself is always really, really good, too. You know, being disciplined, but being charitable. And it's sort of a tightrope they have to walk. But as long as, you know, you're not running yourself down with every single sentence that you write, I think eventually the sentences will accrete and create something that you're really proud of.
Was that internal editor something that you had to tamper down in your journey?
Yeah. Well, no. I mean, I come to writing from the perspective of an athlete. I was a big athlete in high school and college. And, you know, what practice is when you're an athlete is just repeated failure day after day. You know, you just fail in order to get better at failing, right? Which is sort of what writing is also. So I had to learn to be kinder to myself, only in that it's okay to be a failure at all times when you're practicing, which is what you're doing as you sit down to write a book. I have this internal editor that I do turn on when it's time to edit, but I try to keep that editor off when I'm actually writing, especially in the first, you know, wild and free longhand drafts. That I do. I just, you know, I send the editor out of the room. And then eventually when I know the story and I know the characters, I invite her back in. But she's tough. She's kind of mean.
Is she furious?
She's furious. She's always furious. Actually, so I met Grace Paley only once in my entire life. But she has sort of like a Grace Paley toughness to her, which I love, actually, whoever this editor is.
Well, Lauren, thank you so much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
That was Lauren Groff, author of the new novel, Fates and Furies, published by Riverhead. During the second part of the show, Garth Risk-Hallberg, author of the book City on Fire, will be here. So stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine and streaming on the web at kuci.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available via podcast and also available on Stitcher. You can always visit Barbara DeMarco Barrett's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads as well as information on past shows and upcoming shows. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. I'm your co-host, Nicole Nelson. In the first part of the show, I spoke with novelist Lauren Groff. Next up, I'll be speaking with author Garth Risk-Hallberg. Garth has an MFA from New York University and is the author of the novella A Field Guide to the North American Family. His work has been anthologized in Best New American Voices 2008, Best of the Web 2008, and The Late American Novel. His stories and essays have been published in the New York Times Magazine and Book Review, Glimmer Train, New York Magazine, Slate, The Los Angeles Times, and other places. His debut novel, causing quite a stir, is City on Fire, published by Knopf. I spoke with him earlier in the week. An audio note, my mic is a little distorted, but his is okay. And I started by asking him what his book was about.
It's a kind of sprawling Dickensian novel that follows 9 different primary characters through the tumultuous and disorderly streets of New York City in the mid-1970s. And the shooting of one of them in Central Park on New Year's Eve sort of sets off a string of mysteries and revelations that gradually bring to light connections among the characters that are deeper than they might have suspected, and ideally illuminates the way that the connections among us are deeper than we might imagine.
And could you talk just about a little bit about the genesis of the novel, where the idea came from?
Sure. The idea arrived very suddenly, sort of like getting an unwanted or unasked for package on your doorstep and wondering what's in this box. It came to me in the summer of 2003, and I was probably at that point, you know, 15 years. I was, I think, 24 years old. But I was 15 years into a love affair with New York City, which had started out as reading Harriet the Spy and Stuart Little, and then progressed as I was a teenager into listening to Patti Smith and Lou Reed. And then in my late teenage years, had taken the form of kind of a frequent series of visits to the city from the little town in North Carolina where I grew up, about 800 miles away. And I had always kind of known that that was where I was going to end up. Because it always seemed to me like the place where people who don't fit anywhere else, you know, can find a home. And I felt very much like that growing up, which, of course, everyone does to some degree or another, that you don't fit in. But it's a feeling I gave to a lot of characters in the book. And in 2003, I was actually kind of coming up to look at apartments. Like, my wife and I, I guess we were a year from getting married, but we were about to kind of finally make this move to the city. We had been deterred by student loans for like several years prior to that. We'd always ended up going to the schools we could afford, which were not in New York. But now we were going to finally do it. But I had spent the previous 18 months since September 11th, 2001, which was kind of like the first formative event of my post-collegiate life, like ruminating about the meaning of that event and what it had sort of exposed by exposing the fragility of a city that it always seemed to me like it would always be there waiting. And I was thinking a lot about, you know, because there was a period during that day in September of 2001 where you didn't know how many planes there were, and therefore it seemed possible that the whole thing was just going to go. And I was just trying to think really hard about what really would have been lost like aside from the unconscionable loss of human life. Like, what do all those human lives together mean? And what does it mean that so many different human lives can find a way to coexist when reason tells us that they shouldn't? And I was on a bus, you know, out right outside of the city in New Jersey where you sort of first see the skyline, and it was the same bus I used to take as a teenager, and I heard this Billy Joel song on my iPod. I'd never heard it before because I'm not a big Billy Joel listener, but that's kind of the magic of the iPod. And it was about the city in the mid-70s, which is the era of punk and of the fiscal crisis and of this riotous blackout of 1977. And it just seemed to me that that would be, you know, the arena for, like, seeing in its most exposed form the fragility of the kinds of the freedom and the possibility and the metropolitan ideal of coexistence that had always meant so much to me. And that it would be the world, you know, that I had daydreamed my way into as a teenager listening to Patti Smith. And I make this sound very cerebral in hindsight, but really it was just this feeling. It was like, oh, there's this book, and it's going to be like Bleak House, but it's set in 1977, but it's about everything that's going on right now and really matters to me. And that was the genesis.
And moving on just a little bit, I've heard you say that at that moment that you were just describing of the excitement where the book was coming to you, you had about 70% of the story in one blow. And then let me know if that's correct. And also, so you were 24, and I've also heard you say you wrote a scene really fast at that point. And I'm curious what scene that was.
Well, I mean, 70% is more like I'm trying to gesture at the sense that, like, an awful lot of the novel was present to me in that moment. You know, quantifying it is, like, already exaggerating it. But it was like, I had characters. It was like, by the time that song finished playing, I had events, I had plot elements, I had imagery. And I think this sounds crazy, probably, if you're listening, but I have talked to people who've had similar experiences, the kind of cliched, like, flash of inspiration. And yet it was also sort of fused together that I knew it would take me, you know, like 5 years or 6 years or 7 years to get it all sort of pulled apart and find a way through it. So it was present in a very strange way. Like, it was very solid, but it was all, like, kind of, you know, they say, like, there might be 11 dimensions because reality is folded in on itself in all these complicated ways. Like, it felt solid, but very, very folded and very, very dense. So I did get off the bus, and I wrote a scene kind of in the midst of this flash of inspiration. And the scene involves, it's in the it ended up at the end of the second part of the novel, and it's a character who's a banker, and he's an investment banker, or kind of a wealth manager, I guess, and he's at a conference of financiers, and they're having this heated debate in 1975, as the city historically is about to go bankrupt, about whether things like cities are even worth investing in anymore, or whether cities are too dangerous and too disastrous, and like the smart money should go somewhere else. And then he walks down out of this conference, and he spots this strange little man whom he knows sitting on a traffic bollard, and the man offers him a cigarette. It's his uncle, and says, basically, I know you're in trouble, and I can help you. And it's a sort of devil's bargain. And by the time I got to the end of that scene, like, I was so scared by the force and the power of the thing that was trying to come through me that I basically thought, like, I'm 24 years old. I'm a nobody. This is going to be, you know, 800 to 1,000 pages long. And I don't have the chops to do this. And it wants everything from me. And that I close the notebook and I put it in a drawer out of fear, basically. And I thought, well, maybe I'll come back to that in 10 years when I'm writer enough, you know, to not ruin it, if I'm ever writer enough to not ruin it. And I did last about 4 years without touching it, but by the fall of 2007, I had somehow learned again that, like, the fear is the thing that tells you when you're trying to make art that that's the project you should be doing.
I'm talking to Garth Risk-Hellberg. His debut novel is City on Fire. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI in Irvine. Garth, would you read to us from your book?
Sure. I'm going to read the opening paragraphs of chapter 22, which is about a quarter of the way through the novel. And here you're sort of getting to know one of the nine principal characters, whose name is Charlie, and he's a 17-year-old from the suburb of Flower Hill, Long Island, just outside of New York City. Those first few weeks of grief counseling, Charlie took the LIRR in. He was always late, though. Invariably, his train would get hung up in the East River Tunnel. He couldn't tell how much time had passed unless he asked other people. His dad's watch still lay in a coffin-shaped box in his underwear drawer. And the others were already looking at him funny because he was doing his nervous humming thing. Their stares only made him more nervous, which led to more humming. And when he came out of the subway, he'd bolt the last five blocks to the doctor's and arrive sweaty and short of breath, sucking on his inhaler. Dr. Altschul must have said something to Mom, because after he got his driver's license, in May, she insisted on his taking the station wagon, as she'd insisted on the counseling in the first place. The office was on Charles Street, in the half-basement of a brownstone you wouldn't necessarily have known was anything other than a residence. Even the discreet plaque below the buzzer, "All appointments, please ring," made no mention of specialties. This was probably for the peace of mind of clients. Patients? So no one in the waiting room would know what you were there for. Who needed board-certified grief counseling, and who needed whatever it was Dr. Altschul's wife, also, confusingly, named Dr. Altschul, did? Honestly, that Dr. Altschul should be married at all was a mind-bender. He was the kind of bosomy, overweight man who could make even a beard look sexless. Charlie kept trying to memorize the doctor's zippered cardigan so that he could determine at the next session if it was the same one. But as soon as he'd settled in, Dr. Altschul would sort of tip back in his large leather chair and place his hands contentedly on his belly and ask, "So how are we doing this week?" Charlie's own hands stayed tucked under his thighs. "We were doing fine." Which could mean only one thing. Charlie was still in denial. For 8 or 10 weeks now, he'd been resisting the pressure of Dr. Altschul's questions, the Buddha-like invitation of those flattened but not knotted fingers. Charlie focused instead on the oddments of the therapist's desk and walls. Diplomas, little carved wood statuettes, intricate patterns woven into the tasseled rug. He'd had the suspicion from the very first that Dr. Altschul, Bruce, he kept telling Charlie to call him, meant to vacuum out his skull, replace whatever was there with something else. It was connected with the doctor's studious skirting of the word father and its equivalents, which, of course, kept the person they referred to at the very front of Charlie's mind. But suppose they were right, the school guidance counselor, his mom. Suppose the dead father lodged in his skull was making him sick, and suppose Dr. Altschul could pry Dad out like a bad tooth. What, then, would be left of Charlie? So we talked instead about school and Pee Wee League, about the Sullivans and Ziggy Stardust. When given a homework assignment, think about a moment he'd been scared, he talked about the terrifying dentist his mom used to make him go see on the 38th floor of the Hamilton Sweeney building. How old Dr. DeMoto once scraped his plaque onto a saltine and made him eat it. And how the window, inches away from his chair, gave onto a sheer drop of 600 feet. Mom had this idea that for the finest care, you had to go to Manhattan. In fact, maybe ponying up for a fancy head shrinker now was contrition for Dad. Maybe she thought if he'd been rushed after the second heart attack to a hospital in the city, he'd still be alive. Heights, that's what scares me, Charlie said. And fires and snakes. One of these wasn't even true. He'd put it in to test Dr. Altschul or throw him off the trail.
Thank you. That was Garth Risk-Hellberg reading from his debut novel, City on Fire. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM, KUCI, in Irvine. And Garth, so that was an introduction to Charlie, and I've heard you talk about Charlie in the context of your keen gift for observation. So you told a story about seeing a young man with pajama bottoms on, I think, on a cold day in the subway, and that's a detail you immediately, you know, realized could apply to Charlie. So these details that you observe out there in the world, how do you organize them? Do you have a notebook, or what do you do with them?
I'm not sure if it is a keen gift for observation so much as a kind of learning disability. I sometimes feel like I have this kind of inability to, like, filter out the incoming data for relevance when I'm just walking around that renders me basically, like, unfit to keep my own shoes tied, but that is somehow an asset in the only job in the world for which I am remotely qualified, which is writing. So, I mean, the quick answer to your question is that I don't really organize them. I do keep a notebook, but that is the sort of thing, you know, I think that particular incident where I was on the LIRR and I saw this kid on a winter day, I was commuting out to the suburbs in the morning, and I saw this kid also riding out to the suburbs from the city, and he had on sort of, like a parka up top, but only pajama bottoms on bottom, which meant that he had to be either wearing pajama bottoms when he went into the city or somehow had ended up in pajama bottoms without his pants. And I think that that's the kind of thing that, like, somehow I just, like, notice and it sticks with me, and I think there's a story there, and then it joins all of the other things that I'm holding on to somewhere in the back of my head. And because I haven't written them down, I feel this pressure to remember, and then gradually they sort of, like, you know, fuse together. So I'll just be, like, writing, you know, moving the pencil across the page, and all of a sudden some half-forgotten thing that I've noticed somewhere, like, leaps to the end of the pencil. So it's almost like strategic disorganization. Like, the novel itself is the way of organizing them.
Mm-hmm. And one of your strengths for me as a reader is the way that you draw chapters to a close. I think those are called fade-outs, but I'm not sure. You find a nice balance between achieving some closure and maintaining momentum. And so I'd love to hear you talk about crafting those, or if it's at all done consciously.
Yeah, there's this whole, like, screenwriter's dialect of, like, fade-outs and arcs and flashbacks and backstory that I really kind of reject as, you know, as a fiction writer. Like, I think, you know, anytime that I catch myself thinking in those kinds of cinematic terms or in that vocabulary, like, I feel like I end up with something contrived. So I'm really interested in, like, kind of interrogating those and asking, like, well, is there really such a thing as a backstory? Like, isn't someone's past, you know, if it belongs in the novel, shouldn't it also be as alive as the present and sort of as ongoing and be haunting the present? But for the ends of chapters, like, if you can get away from that schematic way of thinking about it and just kind of notice what the work wants. I think in a book that has 94 chapters, part of what this kind of like end of each chapter wants is to find a new way to end a chapter so that it's never quite repeating the same motion twice, so that the reader is always slightly surprised to hit the white space at the end. And that, for me, is sometimes very effortless, and sometimes it's very effortful. So sometimes it's like, you know, it just kind of is right there, and I'm like, you know, that's where the chapter wants to end. And other times I have to go back and sort of hunt for, like, you know, where, basically, what's the point at which things stop changing? And then can I, like, somehow arrest this motion in the middle of its change so as to suggest sort of where it might be headed? And in either case, effortless or effortful, I experience it as listening. I know that when I'm writing well, for me, not necessarily for the reader, but, like, you know, the reader might be like, this thing's a disaster. But for me, when it feels like it's what I want to be doing, it feels a lot like I'm listening in real time to the words as they come out and kind of trying to feel the rhythm of them. And often if I'm listening well enough, like, there's a little thing that happens at a certain point where a paragraph goes, you know, stop here, like, nothing after this. Don't, you know, like, that's enough. But it remains sort of mysterious to me.
And you mentioned in there the skills of screenwriters, or rather their tricks, and I believe the movie rights have been sold. Are you involved at all in creating the script, or are you not?
No, I mean, that's like sort of the great irony, and in some ways I was trying to take something. I had this, like, slightly, even in the period when I had this thing in a drawer for 4 years because it scared me, in part because I looked around and other people didn't seem to be, like, I couldn't see other examples of what I was doing except if I went back to the 19th century or what I wanted to do. But except for, like, this kind of serial TV storytelling, like on Sunday nights, the fact that people would pay attention to The Wire, The Sopranos for 70 or 80 hours made me think that maybe this kind of long-form storytelling might not be dead, might still have things to tell us. But in writing the book, I kind of thought about it as like trying to take that stuff back from television and movies and like to reanimate it with all the things only the novel can do, which is like interiority and subjectivity and, you know, depth of character. And so I felt like, in a way, like I was writing against the conventions of TV while, you know, or movies, while reclaiming some of the things that I thought they were taking for the novel. And this is all like half facetious, you know, but I was kind of like an athlete trying to psych yourself up for an event. You're like, you guys can't have that. And so it was very, like, it was a great irony to me that anyone would want to make, you know, anything filmic or televisual out of it. And I just kind of see my job as, like, you know, trying to write the next book and to not worry about those things. I mean, TV and film can be, like, great works of art in themselves, but I'm not sure they always benefit from having the writer standing in, of the, you know, the source material standing in the middle and being like, well, here's my vision, because my vision is the book. You know, that's what I really wanted to kind of give to readers. And just because I can, you know, drive, you know, be a long-distance trucker doesn't mean I'm cut out to be an airline pilot, you know?
That's really
interesting. It seems like two different skill sets.
Yeah, and now that you say that about the book, how it's sort of a reaction against that, I think I sense that in the way that it's written, and I like that. So you read nicely, and there's a book trailer available online, and I think it's you doing the voiceover, is that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And so how about the audiobook?
If I had been approached, I might have. I enjoy reading, and I enjoy doing the voices, and I like giving readings. I like reading out loud. I have two little kids, and I read out loud to them all the time. And I mean, you can really ham it up, you know, when you do that. But so I think if anyone had wanted me to, I probably would have been persuadable in some sense, but it was also a huge relief when they were like, we want to cast the book, you know, the audio book. And so they have one voice doing the kind of primary narration, and they cast a bunch of different actors reading the interludes, you know, as the different characters. And to my great delight, one of them was Bronson Pinchot, who I grew up with as TV's cousin Balky, and who, of course, has done a great number of distinguished things since then. But I was like, perfect strangers, that's amazing.
I'm talking to Garth Riss Hallberg, whose debut novel is City on Fire. You're listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KCI in Irvine. And Garth, unfortunately, we're drawing down on our time, but before I let you go, I'd like to ask you if you have any writing advice for our writer listeners.
My favorite piece of writing advice, and it goes against all notions of craft, but it is, if there's something that sticks out in the work as a potential problem, either you're doing too much of it or you're doing too little of it. So sometimes you can fix things that seem like they shouldn't be there by, like, doing more of them, like pushing them harder. And that's always worked for me and gotten me out of some tight spots.
Mm. Well, Garth, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
That was author Garth Riss Hallberg. His debut novel, City on Fire, is out and published by Knopf. And he'll be in Southern California with a reading and book signing at Romans in Pasadena at 7 p.m. on Thursday, November 6th, tomorrow night. That's Romans on Colorado Avenue. That's all the time we have for today. Next week, Barbara will be here, and at that point, we'll be in full fun drive mode. The fall fun drive begins officially on Friday, but you can give any time just by clicking on the donate button at KUCI.org. Stay tuned for Positive Vibrations with Sister Rue coming up next on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Until next time, thanks for joining us. Have a great day.